This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Wyatt Lopez of Hayworth is a 4-H contestant who's not doing rabbits, roosters, pigs, or cows at the McLean County Fair. And stop-motion animation is even passé.
It was fun to do, but I wanted to try to kind of expand my boundaries and learn more about other types of filmmaking, mainly live action.
Eric Stock reports on 4-H in the 21st century. Plus, it's getting on toward the start of school, but the traditional rhythms of K-12 are not for everyone. Ryan Denham reports on an alternative to that, Bloom Community School, which builds itself as a progressive and innovative elementary and middle school. And storyteller Devin Lovell talks about losing and finding. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Parents and kids around Bloomington Normal are about to snap back into their old routines as Unit 5 and District 87 resumes classes after summer break next week. But for one private school in Normal, old habits have been expelled. Bloom Community School bills itself as a progressive and innovative elementary and middle school where kids become independent learners. One of its co-founders is Laura Kelmis, a professor of education policy and philosophy at Illinois State University. She says her school is well-suited to the Bloomington Normal community.
For many people who are affiliated with ISU, we know that ISU was originally the Normal school, and the community has really grown up around this idea of preparing teachers for the future of our democratic society. So in that vein, Bloom Community School was created as a place to equip young people to be independent thinkers and collaborative community members and also engaged learners.
How did the first year go?
This was an extraordinary year of growth and learning for all of us, and we knew that going into it. We approached the school year as being students first and foremost. What we're doing at Bloom is really unique, and I can say that with some confidence because the work I do at Illinois State University as a policy analyst and a professor is to study progressive education. And we are trying to marry these dual paradigms of being both student-centered and inquiry-driven, but also standards-based and aligned. And that is not something that's really being done, certainly not anywhere here in this region, but also across the country. So the first year was us stepping into theory and research about what best practice would look like and trying to actualize that. And that was a challenge. We had a phenomenal group of people supporting us in rising to that occasion. And many of those were ISU faculty and educational experts in the community who were mentoring and guiding us through this process of trying to learn how theory can become practice.
I know I imagine you've been working on this for some time and pulling it together, and you finally open your doors. What was your proudest moment from year one?
Yeah. The proudest moments weren't usually the ones with confetti and applause, but they tended to be subtle moments where we begin to see children changing their relationship to each other and to themselves and to the community they're a part of. I could give many proud moments, kind of like any parent who watches their child or children growing, but I think one that really stands out to me is one of the members of our little school became really sick and was hospitalized in the middle of the school year. And the students came together one morning and we made the announcement about their fellow classmates' illness. And the response that they demonstrated was such a beautiful and empathic one. And really, I think what we want to see in all adults in that they modeled real, genuine care and consideration for someone that they had grown to care and love for this academic this past academic year. And then they really had some concrete ideas of how they could support her. So they visited her over the coming months in the hospital and put together care packages and ended up doing some other kind of community-based awareness-raising activities around the illness. So that's one example. Academically, there were so many. These were a daily process of discovery and excitement. I think a capstone project that was a really proud moment was the students had generated a kind of research problem for themselves in our Blossom classroom, which was fifth and sixth graders. And the question was around environmental degradation and pollution. That is both a global issue, but also a local one. And so after doing some research and study of pollution and how it works in a kind of environmental sense, they created experiments to collect and measure pollution locally on our site at Normandy Village, and then strategized and brainstormed of how can they take responsibility for these problems that they're now coming to know in an intimate and academic way. And so out of that came this great project where they devised an aquaponics unit. And this was a self-contained system of a water system and a plant system, and it involved fish and herbs that they planted. And it was about how we can create renewable energy and really safe environmental systems for our local community.
What would you say was your biggest challenge in your first year?
So earlier, I did mention that what we're doing is really unique and distinct among education in general, but especially in a progressive education model, and it's very ambitious. So I think one of the challenges as we stepped into the school year was recognizing that there's as much unlearning to do as learning in this environment, that all of us who have been in school environments where we are told what to learn and how to learn it, and then we are given assessments that are going to demonstrate whether or not we retained and understood that information, have developed a kind of alienation to our own learning. And that's true for all of us. You know, even for me as someone who studies these systems and critically engages them, we all had to walk into this ongoing process of unlearning this at last year, practices that don't necessarily serve kids. And so often we would come back again and again to whether the practices we were doing on a weekly basis reflect our vision and our mission at Bloom of believing kids are natural learners, believing that education should enhance individuality and not demand conformity, believing kids have the capacity to change their communities and their world. And oftentimes we found we were reverting to old practices that weren't aligned with our school. So having the courage to be able to really clearly acknowledge where those moments were happening and then redirect out of those became essential to our growth this past year. And I would say one of the really beautiful lessons for us is that those moments where we saw that we needed to redirect or recalibrate our approaches, and those kind of moments that present themselves sometimes as problems are actually these beautiful learning opportunities that are helping us to refine our approach in ways that are more authentic to the vision for the school.
Yeah, what's an example of an old habit that may be easy to fall into that you want to snap back out of to go in the new direction that you want to take Bloom?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many everyday examples. But one is there's an idea that teachers ought to have a lot of control over children and that the classroom is really predicated on control. So teachers decide when children use the bathroom, when they get to eat or drink, if they get to move and move their bodies, if they're allowed to ask questions. And so there was a long process in the beginning of thinking through, is it really a problem for a child to get a snack when he or she is hungry so that that child can focus during the lesson? Do we really need to monitor all the time when kids are drinking water, when they're using the bathroom? We made time and space every week to sit down with our ISU partners, many of whom have deep expertise in these areas of research and practice, and community partners, and talk about how are we planning for the upcoming week, how are we reflecting on the past week, and discussing these practices that that we've been utilizing and really trying to question and hold each other accountable as to whether or not it has to be that way. So this has been an exercise of really reimagining imagining what education can be. And that is hard for those of us who have been through a very traditional preparation program for all of our lives.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Laura Kalmus, a co-founder of Bloom Community School in Normal. We're also joined by Jen Stubbs, a teacher and coordinator of Bloom's new early learning program called Seedlings. Jen, Bloom School has multi-grade classrooms. So socially, what are the benefits and downsides of blended aged classrooms?
In this pilot year with the early learning program, we're going to be mixing the four-year-old, actually one will be turning four, so he'll be three when the year starts, with 5- and 6-year-olds, and sort of seeing, you know, you said socially, we're really, really excited about this process of social-emotional development that's going to be able to happen for these children. 5- and 6-year-olds tend to be sort of the bottom of the barrel when it comes to an educational system for the most part. They're the babies. They're the new ones. They're the ones that need to be walked through everything. And in this classroom, the 5- and 6-year-olds are going to be the older ones, and they're going to be able to sort of see their own purpose and ability to help the younger children. We see this a lot in families with multiple children, and back in the times where families used to have lots and lots of kids, this happened sort of naturally within the home, but anymore it's becoming less and less common for children to grow up with that mixed age group. They may have one or two siblings at most. So to be able to have that in a classroom environment and to have that sort of growth happen for the youngers to sort of have a role to play and the olders as well, that happens when you have that mixed age. Whereas when children are all the same age, they tend to sort of see peers and not so much their ability to do something within that group.
Well, and since the American education system generally relies upon standards in education and grade levels and all that, how does Bloom ensure that kids will be able to kind of play the game if they, you know, if and when they transition to a more traditional school environment? I mean, you don't have a high school on your campus, on your building. So that'll happen at some point. So how do you think about that transitional period later on in their lives?
Right, and this is really important to us because we want to equip children to be successful across all areas of academics and life, really. So as I said before, we are a standards-based and a standards-aligned program, but instead of approaching education as covering standards, which is what many schools and classrooms do, we treat it as uncovering standards. So it takes a level of mastery and a kind of different relationship for the teacher to implement this with students and with learning opportunities. But we try to create authentic learning experiences for kids based out of their own questions. And then through a process that's known as backward mapping, we take a look at the standards. We see what they have already accomplished in ways that were generated by their own curiosity and enthusiasm. And then where there are gaps or where we need to refine the learning, we then cultivate experiences that can help students go deeper in those areas.
What does your typical family look like?
I would say the really unifying quality among all of our families, and we have a very diverse community of learners because that's been part of our mission, is to recruit children from across Bloomington Normal to be representative of the demographic and economic community we live in here. So I should start by saying we are a diverse community of learners. 40% of our children are on a scholarship program. So for those where finances would prohibit them from accessing the school and tuition would be cost prohibitive, we have subsidized a lot of our seats. So that aside, I would say that the thing they have in common is they have a deep investment in equipping and empowering their children to become independent learners, to become agents in their own lives and in their communities. They value the relationships as the kind of focal point and center of the school. And out of that, they really, I think, hope for their children to develop an awareness of their own learning strengths and some of their challenges so that they can continue to become lifelong learners.
Right. So I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 2.5-year-old son. If my 5-year-old went to Bloom, and I'm a parent there, my wife and I, how are the expectations on me as a parent different at Bloom versus at, you know, the grade school that she would otherwise attend in Unit 5 or District 87?
I think the expectations would be really reflected in this concept of community. A community is something we create together, And oftentimes when we send our kids to school, I have a 10, an 8, and a 4-year-old. You get them on the bus or you drop them at the doors and you say goodbye. And you may have opportunities to volunteer, but beyond that, you don't have a kind of intimate relationship necessarily with the teachers or other students in the classroom. I would say at Bloom, the experience there is very much one of parents being embedded into the process of learning that's happening for their kids too. If we take seriously that kids are that we need to treat children as whole learners and whole people, that necessarily means we invite families into that process too. We often, in the classrooms and in our relationships to school as parents and adults, treat education as a transaction, and it's very didactic. So it flows from one place to another. The knowledge flows from the teacher to the child, the administration to the teachers, and that looks very hierarchical too. And as a school that prioritizes and emphasizes community, we really recognize that everyone has something to offer, something inimitable that wouldn't be available from anyone else. And so we try to honor that by creating opportunities for families to participate in that community and enrich it with their unique skills or interests or backgrounds as a family.
So you're starting a new early learning program for children ages 4 to 5 this year. It's called the Seedling Class, and that's Jen's involvement here. So Jen, what is that class going to look like?
Wow, we're really excited about it. I am wrapping my head around it still to this day as we speak, because it's becoming something new every day. I'm working very closely with Jessica Frederick, who has come over to join the team, and she originally was going to be in charge of the kindergarten classroom, but when we decided to bring on Seedlings, Jess and I talked about whether we wanted to do two separate classes sort of operating in the same big space or combine both of them. And the conversation very naturally led to, well, of course, both of these will be combined and we'll plug in our skill sets with each group so that we can see that all unfolding. What my priorities are as the Seedlings coordinator is just making sure that we fill that whole child in all the domains of development. So what we're looking specifically at is making sure that children are developing early math skills within their format that they're working with, the early literacy skills, the whole language approach of documenting and using language and bringing attention to language as much as possible. We're going to have a very huge art focus because I feel like art is something that is not just static. It is something that is constantly happening and is a mindset. And I want that art focus to be something that is happening intrinsically within the literacy, within the math, within all of the areas that the children are learning. Social emotional development is also a very, very big piece of early childhood learning. It continues to be as they get older. But with young children, they're still learning a lot of the mechanics of what is a friend? How do I make a friend? What are the kinds of language words that I use when I want to talk to a friend? How do I say hello? How do I do an interview? You know, we're going to be kind of building that with those kids. And then last but not least, because this is sort of my pet area, is a nature focus. So really getting the children outside of the classroom as much as possible to interact with nature, and then bringing nature into the classroom as much as we can when we can't be outside. And again, tying nature into all of those different areas.
That's Jen Stubbs, teacher and coordinator of Bloom Community School's new early learning program. She was joined in studio by Laura Kalmus, a co-founder of Bloom. I'm Ryan Denham.
Bloom currently has around 30 students. It's located on Beach Street in Normandy Village in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport, encouraging travelers to support the local economy and enjoy a convenient airport experience, including free parking. CIRA says, don't travel before you travel. Fly local. Details and schedules at CIRA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up on GLT's Sound Ideas, 4-H in the 21st century. Eric Stock has more. And now for the political sex scandal of the week. The Illinois Politics Roundtable delves into the case of a first-term Republican House lawmaker from Barrington Hills, Illinois, who has now resigned. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield. He's in charge of the public affairs reporting program there. Daisy Contreras and Brian Mackey work the State House Bureau for IPR, and John O'Connor is with the Associated Press. O'Connor starts off with the background of Nick Sauer.
Politico broke the story that a former girlfriend of Nick Sauer, who's a first-term Republican from Lake Barrington, had filed complaints with the Chicago Police Department and the Legislative Ethics Inspector General, the Inspector General for the legislature, that Sauer had taken explicit photos of the woman whom she had sent to him privately and posted them on a fake Instagram account under her name as a means of engaging other men in conversation on the social media platform. The complaint became public through this published report, and the House Minority Leader, Jim Durkin of Western Springs, immediately put out a statement saying that Sauer would resign. So it was clear that he had asked Sauer to resign later that day. That was Wednesday. Sauer did submit his resignation.
And John, are there any charges filed against him at this point? Anything criminal that's been alleged here?
No, nothing that we're aware of. And it's the woman said that she had begun a long-distance relationship with him from California in 2016 after they met on Tinder, which is a dating app, and it was during this time that they were in different parts of the country that she said she sent these intimate photos to him. She moved to Chicago the spring of 2017 to be nearer to him, she told Politico, and the relationship ended in March of 2018. It wasn't until early July, that a man whom she previously did not know contacted her and said he had been communicating with someone on Instagram who purported to be that woman, and that's when she became aware that these photos were out there. But as she said, Sauer had posted these photos as a way to bait men into sexually explicit conversations. Sauer would not respond to any requests for comment from the Associated Press, so we don't know what his response is to these allegations. There is a state law that took effect in 2015 that prohibits what's called revenge porn. And in this day and age of social media, this is a prohibition on the posting on social media explicit photos of someone without the permission of the subject of the photos. The idea being that if I want to get back at an ex-girlfriend, I may have explicit photos of her and post them for all the world to see. This is now a felony, which carries a penalty of up to 3 years in prison and a $25,000 fine.
And it's my understanding you don't even have to really prove that you had intent to harm the person. You just have to be proven that you actually shared these images. So while, you know, I think, Sean, you had asked, are there any criminal charges? We have heard reports that there are investigations going on, not only the legislative inspector general, but also police investigation. But as of yet, there have not been any criminal charges. But, you know, there is the possibility if some of these allegations are founded or law enforcement authorities determine that they have enough to move forward, that is something that could come later.
And of course, everyone is innocent until proven guilty.
Absolutely.
But Brian, I think it was interesting how quickly Representative Sauer did step down from this. And, of course, it is an election year. He was up for re-election because in the House, they're all up for election every 2 years. John alluded to the fact that this likely came with some nudging from Republican leaders. In this whole Me Too era that we're in, and as highly charged as that has been over the last many months with the Illinois Capitol, I'm sure Republicans, and I would guess you would agree, were probably working behind the scenes to try to get him out as quick as possible.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, it's obviously something you want to get ahead of. And it's interesting, though, because we have seen various people take different approaches to whether or not they resign right away when you know, quote unquote, Me Too allegations come forward. We saw the House Democratic chief of staff, who was accused of really just sort of making inappropriate comments about the appearance of some of the women who worked in the House clerk's office, the nonpartisan staff, and, you know, not taking his responsibilities seriously, making jokes about harassment training, things like that, resigned immediately. But we've seen other state legislators who have been accused of inappropriate behavior persist. State Senator Ira Silverstein, you know, decided to stick around, and he ended up losing his primary election, so he will be out of office at the end of this year or early next year. State Representative Lou Lang was also somebody who had accusations of inappropriate behavior. Now, there was immediate pushback, not only by Representative Lang and others about that, but you know, they did not choose to act nearly as swiftly as we saw with Representative Sauer this week. So you know, people can make of that what they will. It seems like the House Republican leadership, though, was eager to have this behind them.
Well, I would argue that Silverstein is the outlier. He was the first example of allegations of this type in Illinois after the so-called this resurgence of the Me Too movement last fall that started with Harvey Weinstein and spelled the downfall of many powerful men in media and politics and entertainment. Now, this is the first time that the Republicans have had to face this, but I think that their reaction was, I should say the Democrats' reaction in the past was very similar. In the case of the House clerk, Timothy Mapes, or in the case of Lou Lang, these were situations where the Democratic House Speaker, Michael Madigan of Chicago, had already last winter faced allegations of his own, not against him personally, but that he had not properly managed allegations of sexual harassment against campaign workers in his political organization. So he was on the defensive last winter. So when Lang or Timothy Mapes, these situations came up, it's cut them loose immediately.
Although Lang has his legislative seat, he just resigned from the leadership position.
Absolutely.
In the House.
Which is pretty...
That's a big deal.
Yeah,
and Governor Rauner has also made sure to remind people that, you know, this is, you know, for him, at least, he's saying that this is a Madigan problem. Earlier in the week, Governor Rauner, in an unrelated event, he was asked, you know, if he thought Sauer's departure was the right thing to do, and he said, yes, it's right for him to step down, but then he deflected and went ahead and said, well, Michael Madigan has nurtured a culture of abuse at the Capitol, and you know, as John said earlier, this is the first Republican that we see being accused of these sexual allegations. And the speaker later said that he's committed to making sure that they're creating a positive culture and an environment in the Capitol.
I think Charlie's always said this is always, you know, the way women have been treated at the Capitol, that's been bipartisan through the years. And so we were waiting for something to come out about a Republican because we had seen so many things happening with Democrats. This is not one party or the other.
No, but
it should
I would
be
say
noted
that this is quite different from whatever culture there is at the Capitol, mm-hmm. because what I referred to, the bipartisan stuff, was guys being obnoxious to women, hitting on women all the time, grabbing, that kind of thing. Not, of course, back in my day it didn't exist, not posting nude photos of someone online. And Sauer is hardly part of the culture. He's been here, what, not even mm-hmm. 2 years mm-hmm. yet. And he was Bruce Rauner's appointment to the Illinois Tollway Authority. So in a sense, he's Rauner's guy more than he'd be Madigan's guy. But
yeah,
he's an outlier because, in my mind, it's bad enough to be obnoxious around women. But to do something as sneaky and underhanded and deceitful as posting pictures of someone, that just, to me, is beyond the pale.
And Charlie, we've always said through the years, we've said in Illinois, the scandals tend to be, you know, financial. Somebody graft. Somebody's tending to try to line their own pockets off the taxpayers' back or something like that. And it's not been as sexual. I kind of feel after the past year or so, we can't really say that anymore.
Oh, no. It's the, what's the best way to put it? The sexual type stuff always existed in the past, the harassment, the, what would you say, boorish, uncouth behavior of some men towards women, women who were lobbyists, women who were staffers, in some instances, women who were lawmakers. But it was always overshadowed by the dollars. It was, I was at a national conference one time, and somebody was mentioning how in Illinois, your guys don't mess around with all this high school level sexual stuff. They're in it for the big money.
And John or Brian, I mean, going back to what Daisy had mentioned, Governor Rauner's response to all of this week, it seems to me like he could have left his statement at, you know, yes, I think the representative should step down. I oppose this type of activity, of course, you know, and I'd look down upon that. And then to add the political angle that he tried to put into it with Speaker Madigan, that seemed to backfire a bit.
And it struck me when I saw that, and I had planned to, and then asked the governor's office about the fact, as Charlie mentioned, that Sauer was an appointee. Sauer's a school board member. Then he was a county board member. He was a rising star. He's only 35 years old. He was on his way up. And clearly he had caught the attention of Bruce Rauner before he entered the legislature, Rauner appointed him to the tollway board, a part-time job that pays $31,000 a year as of July 1st of 2015. So I think that Rauner kind of felt the pinch, that this one, you know, he wasn't just a random member of the legislature who happened to be a Republican, the governor's party, but that he did have kind of a vested interest in this one.
And, you know, it just fits in keeping with his, you know, it was sort of a coup, I think, in the way he stayed very disciplined on his message, which is basically blah, blah, Madigan, blah, blah, Madigan. And if you watch the Chicago, if the only way you get your news is to watch the Chicago TV reports, which I like to keep up with, because that is how probably a plurality, if not the majority of voters in Illinois get their political news. That's what you saw the governor saying, blah, blah, Madigan, blah, blah, Madigan, in a report about, again, a Republican accused of this behavior, and one who had gotten the imprimatur, or imprimatur, however you say that, from Governor Rauner in the past with his appointment to the Tollway Board. So it was it goes to show that this governor is very good about messaging, and he has a very clear message, and no matter what question you ask, he will find a way to make the answer, blah, blah, Madigan, blah, blah, Madigan.
Brian Mackey is the State House reporter for IPR. Also on the Illinois Politics Roundtable this week, John O'Connor of the Associated Press, IPR's Daisy Contreras and Sean Crawford, and Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield.
What's fake? What's real? Online, on air, and in print, it can be hard to tell. August 8th, celebrate the 5th anniversary of Sound Ideas with a community conversation, local journalism in the era of fake news. Panelists include Jim Kirk, most recently editor-in-chief of the LA Times.
We are accurate. That is the number one goal, especially in this era.
Celebrate 5 years of Sound Ideas, August 8th, with a discussion on journalism and fake news. Find details at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Forget-Me-Not Flowers, where they're offering beat-the-heat deals throughout July and August on seasonal merchandise, gifts, silks, and home decor. You can find your treasures at 1208 North Towanda Avenue in Towanda Plaza. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Up in a moment on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, a storyteller who gives us perspective on the kindnesses of strangers. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you haven't been to the McLean County Fair's 4-H show in a few years, you might be surprised. It has long been associated with things like livestock and traditional pastimes, baking, quilting, things like that. But as GLT's Eric Stock found out when he served as a judge, organizers of 4-H in McLean County have moved into the 21st century in hopes of staying relevant to today's tech-savvy youth.
Once you walk past the roosters and then file past the horses and all the other animals on display on the Interstate Center grounds in Bloomington, you get to the giant pole barn dubbed Cloverleaf Auditorium, that is headquarters for the 4-H show. Inside is a maze of young people, many of them with their parents, all hustling in a controlled chaos to get from one 4-H contest to the next. Many of them are in a half dozen competitions or more in a single day. There's the traditional programs like gardening and quilting and woodworking, but there's also several contests designed to capture the attention of today's tech-savvy youth. One such contest, this reporter judged, is animated video production. 17-year-old Tristan Frederick of Bloomington describes the video he produced.
At the start of the video, there's several planes flying through the air.
And the homeschooler drew the fighter planes on his iPad at home.
In a couple seconds, you should see some enemy fighters coming in from the top that are going to start attacking them.
Tristan made two self-animated videos, which he says took more than a month to produce. He doesn't plan animated or video production as a career, but figures he still picked up some life lessons along the way.
It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of trying, retrying, and just keep trying until you get it right.
One of the other contestants hopes to use his video production skills to make music videos someday. Wyatt Lopez of Hayworth, who is also homeschooled, produced a video which plays on what he calls the frat boy stereotype. Wyatt has an older brother who goes to Illinois State.
Because I thought that would be really funny. I wanted to change it up from stop motion, which has been what I did for the last 2 years, because it was fun to do, but I wanted to try to kind of expand my boundaries and learn more about other types of filmmaking, mainly live action.
But live action poses its own challenges.
You know, you can't move someone's leg exactly how you want it, you know. You kind of have to rely on other people kind of knowing the same things, having the same vision you do.
Video and filmmaking are just two among a host of new categories that 4-H has added in recent years to better connect with today's post-millennials, or what some call the iGeneration, as in iPhone, children who don't know a world without smartphones. Bobby Lewis Sibley is the University of Illinois Extension Director for McLean, Livingston, and Woodford Counties, which puts on the annual 4-H show. She says the fair has to adapt to what young people want, even if it's at the expense of more traditional programs.
How it's changed over the years, I know it can be frustrating for some people, but actually good for others, and mainly our youth. So, you know, we find that a lot more youth are not maybe enrolling in things like, you know, clothing, but our project areas in technology have grown.
Another recent addition to the 4-H fair, Legos. Students use Lego pieces to create intricate automobiles, ships, castles, and whatever else indulges their imagination. Sarah Toole has been judging Legos at the 4-H fair for 3 years. She says Lego players of today will become the builders of tomorrow.
Creativity. I mean, a lot of problem solving. I mean, there's construction involved. You got to find the right Lego pieces. There's a lot of intricate pieces. So there's a lot of problem solving if they fall apart or break, or construction that doesn't fall apart at the fair and stay still. And then there's moving pieces. So there's a lot more to Legos than just what people think.
Students can also try their hand at computer programming. Chris Miller has been judging the students' computer skills for 5 years.
I'll be honest, really good programs that I'm kind of impressed knowing that the younger generations are coming up and being strong in programming. And I've also seen students that have waited to the last minute to turn stuff in, like some of us would normally do in our day-to-day world.
And while the students tend to go at their own pace, there's no school grade after all. Miller and fellow Judge Renee Collins say those who participate are getting an all-important education outside the classroom, whether they realize it or not.
It's nice to get that learning and that education done now when it's something that they're interested in, as opposed to being forced to do something later that they don't really want to learn.
School versus fun.
Yeah, that's right.
4-H is looking to further its direction into the future with what it calls a STEAM Day. STEAM in this case stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, or Ag, and Math. Emily Sadler runs the STEAM program for the Extension Office. She says the event is for kids of all ages to watch and take part in technology demonstrations.
Because 4-H is so typically focused on agriculture, and that seems to be our reputation, we really want to showcase the other areas that we've got going on with 4-H. So the new STEM project areas are a big hit for us.
Lewis Sibley says not all traditional 4-H programs are going the way of the dodo bird. For example, she says several years ago, organizers considered dropping beekeeping because of a lack of entries. Since then, there's been an apparent resurgence in beekeeping amid concerns about honeybees dying and the impact on honey production and crop pollination. Now, 4-H has more than enough entries for beekeeping. But for those who see the 4-H fair as one of the few remaining links to the area's rich agricultural history, Lewis Sibley says change can be difficult.
Those people who, you know, have grown up with us and are those, you know, traditional 4-H people who've been with us for 50 years, who we still love and adore, they think it's very sad when they see some project areas go down, like clothing. But then we have this other group of people and youth who see things like in STEAM clothing or computer programming and those areas rise up. Then we have that group of people who really absolutely love how 4-H is including these new things.
You're just sort of going with the trends of where the students want to be, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the youth is what 4-H is all about. It is not about us as adults. It is about the youth and their learning engagement in their project areas.
The McLean County Fair wrapped up last Sunday night in Bloomington. The best 4-H entries will have a chance to compete for Best of Show at the Illinois State Fair, which begins Friday in Springfield. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. And now a story of recovery, but not about the kind of recovery you are probably thinking about. Devin Lovell organizes the next to normal story slams held at the McLean County Arts Center. The most recent evening theme for stories told by people from their personal experiences was re, as in again, or return to, or any number of other re-words. As Devin Lovell was reflecting on the theme, she realized she is really lucky.
I've learned some things over the course of the last 50 years, and one of them is that I'm really lucky. And I'm really lucky to have bumped up against so many really, really kind people. So my take on the human race is, yeah, they're a pretty good bunch of people out there. another realization that I've had is that I'm really good at losing things. Over the course of my life, I have lost my purse and my wallet so many times that I can't even count them. Some of the incidents include it falling out of a baby stroller in downtown Evanston, me not knowing, getting home, realizing, retracing my steps, not being able to find it, and then getting a message on my answering machine within a half an hour that some woman had found it and somehow found me, found my phone number, I don't even know how, and had my purse for me. So as many times as I've lost my wallet or my purse, it's been returned to me every single time. Once I was traveling cross-country to visit my family in Virginia, and you know, when you go home, well, you know, when I go home, I don't have to open my wallet because, you know, I'm home and my, you know, we don't go anywhere usually. If we do, mom or dad usually, you know, they say, oh, we've got this. So when it was time for me to leave, I realized, oh, my purse isn't here. And, you know, I'd been there for 2 days already. So I tried going back in my mind to think where was the last place I had left it or remember having it. And that was at the Citgo station in Front Royal, Virginia, about 45 minutes from where my parents live. So I took off with a little loan from my parents, hoping that when I got to the station that maybe it would still be there. And I walked into that gas station, and they said, oh, yeah, we found it. It was hanging on the bathroom stall hook. And so I got my purse back. But the coup de grace of all of these stories probably was several years ago when my kids were smaller. I've got a son and a daughter, and we were once again traveling cross-country to Virginia, and it was just me and them, and this was about the 13th hour of the trip, and it was 10:30 at night, and we had to stop for gas outside of Winchester, Virginia, and this was one of those gas stations that didn't have an attendant. It was just pumps and you put your card in. So it was me and my kids and some bugs flying around the lights. And it was about 10:30. And I'm pumping the gas, and then the kids start having a fight in the back seat, and I get back in the car and I get it all straightened out, and then I, you know, like put the gas nozzle back at the pump and get in the car, and I'm pulling away and I'm looking, I'm like, oh, where's my wallet? And about this time I heard this soft thump, and I think, oh my God, I had left my wallet on top of the car, and surprisingly it stayed up there for a while before it blew off. So I turn the car around. This is a divided highway. I go back, and I'm looking and driving really slowly with the lights on, trying to see it, and I don't see it, and I pull into the station, put the lights on bright, and I'm looking around in the grass, and semis are going by, and I realize this is not getting anywhere. So, and I've got two little kids, and it's late. I decide I'm going to keep on driving. I'm going to call the police. So I called the Winchester police, and after about 10 minutes of talking with them, they realized, oh, no, that gas station's not in Winchester. You got to call the state police. So I hung up, called the state police, and talked to them, and it was a very nice officer, but he didn't sound very hopeful about being able to recover my wallet, which, did I mention, it was about 3x5 in its size. My daughter had gotten it for me at the Art Institute, and it was very special to me, and it had everything in it, my license, my credit cards, my money. So I'm driving towards my dad's house, and my dad lives out in the middle of nowhere, so when you get to his house, you don't have cell service anymore. And by some miracle, as we're going across this high ridge road right before you go down to get to his driveway, my phone rings. And it's the state police of Frederick County, Virginia, and they say, "Ma'am, our officer found your coin purse." And I yell, and the kids yell, like, "Yay!" And then the phone goes dead because we lose reception. But I know they have it. So the next day, I drove back to Winchester, well, back to the Frederick County State Police Office, and got my purse back. I had been run over by a semi. My tokens from the farmer's market were pulverized, but the nice people at the downtown farmer's market reimbursed me for those tokens, so good on them. And good on those officers who went out of their way to find my little tiny purse, which I still have. And I have to say as a footnote to this, that two times in the last week, I've lost this. Last night, I got home from Chicago, and I realized on the train, I don't have my debit card. And by the time I went to sleep, the custodians where I work had texted me that they had found it. So, thank you.
Devin Lovell told her story at the McLean County Arts Center at a Next to Normal Story Slam. GLT will occasionally bring these stories to you during Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.